I want to welcome you. My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Susan Collins and Senator Jay Rockefeller, members of our leadership, welcome you to this program to examine the parts of the Senate and House reform bills, health reform bills, that would set up a health insurance exchange or a set of exchanges to improve the way individual and small group insurance markets function. There are a lot of different models for exchanges, and they can differ pretty widely from each other. Everything from simply a farmers market style website that allows better grasp of the available options to an exclusive, highly regulatory animal that exerts substantial control over who can buy what and at what price. Fortunately, for purposes of our looking at this issue, exchanges do indeed exist in nature, both government-related and privately run. And we're going to hear today from folks who've been running some of those successful exchanges, and we'll hear some about exchanges that haven't been quite so successful. And, of course, we'll look at the exchange provisions of both the House and the Senate bills, a lot of which look pretty similar, but there are some noteworthy differences, and we'll look at those as well. My colleague and co-moderator, Sarah Collins, at the Commonwealth Fund, will be helping us to frame our discussion by laying out very broadly what's in the bills and what issues need to be addressed in reconciling the two versions, which is kind of a nice segue to the fact that our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing is the Commonwealth Fund, which has both commissioned and done some very excellent analysis of this issue, the exchange proposals in the bills, and the idea of an exchange itself. And now let me turn to the aforementioned Sarah Collins. She's the Vice President for the Affordable Health Insurance Program at Commonwealth, and the co-moderator of today's program. She's an economist. She's also the main author of the papers that you have analyzing the provisions of the respective reform bills that were available as handouts. Sarah?
Thank you, Ed, and good afternoon. As Ed mentioned, I'm going to briefly lay out the broad provisions of the House and the Senate reform bills and look at where people in particular are estimated to gain coverage under the bills, in particular the number of people who are covered through the exchanges, and then discuss why we need an insurance exchange and the type of reform bills that are before Congress, and what the key issues are in terms of structure and implementation as we move forward. Everyone knows by now the broad outlines of the bills. They both aim for near universal health insurance coverage by building on what are the strongest aspects of the health insurance system, and large employer-based coverage, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and by regulating and reorganizing the individual and small group insurance markets, which are arguably the weakest parts of the current system. Each bill would bring sweeping change to those markets, which have previously fallen nearly exclusively under the regulatory purview of states, by establishing new federal rules requiring insurance carriers to accept everyone who applies, prohibit rating based on health status, and implement age bans. The bills would create a new health insurance exchange, operated either at the national or state level, for individuals and businesses to purchase health insurance coverage. Sliding scale premium subsidies and cost-sharing subsidies would improve affordability and reduce underinsurance. An essential standard benefit package with different levels of cost-sharing would set a floor for plans offered through the exchange. Income eligibility for Medicaid increased to 133% and 150% of poverty. Large employers required to offer coverage or contribute to the cost, and everyone, or nearly everyone, would be required to have health insurance coverage. In terms of where people would gain or estimated to gain coverage under the bills, these are estimates from the Congressional Budget Office. Employer-based coverage would remain the predominant source of coverage, covering about 160 to 170 million people under the bills. The exchanges are estimated to provide a new source of coverage to 30 million people, either individuals or employees of small companies. Small to mid-sized companies purchasing coverage through the exchange would bring about 5 to 9 million people into the exchanges, so about 30 million covered under the exchanges under both bills. Coverage through the Medicaid program was expected to rise from 35 to 50 million. People uninsured estimated to fall from 56 million estimated in 2019 to 18 million under the House bill and 23 million under the Senate bill. So what is the purpose of an insurance exchange in the context of broad-based health reform proposed in the bills that builds on the existing health insurance system? The individual and small group insurance markets are very poorly organized right now. There are substantial barriers to obtaining coverage. Market rules and consumer protections vary widely across states. Plans are often difficult for people to understand. Large percentage of premium dollars goes to administrative costs. There are a lack of economies of scale, and market competition is based on avoiding risk rather than enhancing value. So exchanges can be designed to provide structure and oversight to insurance markets with goals of improving consumer protections, enhancing transparency of the benefit packages, lowering premium growth, reducing healthcare costs, and changing the competition dynamic from risk to value. The key provisions of the exchanges in terms of their viability over time and their ability to provide comprehensive coverage, reduce costs, include strong market reforms both inside and outside the exchanges, broad risk pooling and individual requirement to have coverage, benefit standards to ensure comprehensive coverage and informed choice, sliding scale premium and cost sharing subsidies that should only be available through the health insurance exchanges, the authority of the exchange to negotiate premiums or set rules of participation for health plans, to negotiate premiums, a choice of high-value plans. Tim Jost is going to provide much more detail on the similarities and differences between the House and Senate bills on the exchanges, as he does in his excellent paper that's included in your packet today. So I'm going to skip the slide and leave that discussion for Tim. And get to some of what I view as some of the key issues regarding the structure and implementation of the exchanges as we move forward. Those include federal versus state operation or control of the exchange, exclusivity of the exchange, and by that I mean whether the exchange becomes the whole market or if the individual and or the small group markets are allowed to exist outside of the exchange. The extent to which the exchange has the authority to negotiate premiums and set rules of plan participation, and whether the rules for participation are aimed at encouraging plan innovation and value in health plan design. And finally, whether the exchange will have the ability long term to risk adjust so that competition between plans is focused on value and not on risk. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Before we move to our panel, let me just do a little housekeeping here. In your packets, you're going to find a lot of good background material, including speaker biography information, much more extensive than we'll have time to give them orally. And you'll find the PowerPoint presentations that you may find hard to read on the screen in your packets as well. If you are watching on C-SPAN and have access to a computer, you can find copies of everything that the folks here have in their kits at our website, which is www.allhealth.org. And for the record, we did not get a letter from C-SPAN asking us to open this briefing to the cameras. We volunteered it. There's a webcast and a podcast available probably Monday at the website kaisernetwork.org, at kff.org. I've got to change that, which stands for Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you very much to the folks who make that possible. You'll find copies of the material there as well as at our website. And in a few days, you'll find on our site a transcript of today's session, which a lot of people find useful in reviewing things very quickly. At the appropriate time, you have question cards in your materials, green cards that you can use to write a question and have it answered by our panelists. There are also some microphones that you can use at the appropriate time. And following the program, I'd appreciate it if you'd fill out and leave with us the blue evaluation forms that are in your packets. Now, let's get to the program. We've got a very knowledgeable group of experts and panelists today. They've got a broad range of experience. We're going to hear some brief presentations, and then we'll have lots of time for discussion and your question. Let's start. Leading off today is Timothy Jost from the Washington Lee University School of Law faculty. He's author, as Sarah noted, of the paper on exchanges that provides the jumping-off point for our discussion today. Tim's written several books on health policy topics, not to mention his co-authorship of the leading casebook on health law called, catchily enough, Health Law, now in its sixth edition. And whether you agree with Tim or not on a particular subject, I think you're going to find his analysis compelling and his writing cogent and accessible for a lawyer or anybody else. So, Tim, thanks for being with us, and look forward to having the conversation.
Thank you very much. I must say, though, that as an aging law professor, PowerPoint is still something I'm not very comfortable with, so I'll do my best to move my slides along, but you might also listen to what I have to say. If there's anything that we can predict with almost absolute certainty about the health reform legislation that will emerge from congressional negotiations in the next month, it is that legislation will include a health insurance exchange. A health insurance exchange is quite simply an organized market for the purchase of health insurance. The exchanges most familiar to us are the Massachusetts Connector, represented here by Mr. Kingsdale, and the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. The Medicare Advantage Program, the Medicare Part D Program, the healthcare systems of Switzerland and the Netherlands, arguably also Germany, also contain many of the elements of an exchange. The health alliances around which the Clinton health plan was built were exchanges, as were and are state-based and private purchasing cooperatives, which have been tried repeatedly and sometimes with success over the past two decades. The Connecticut Business and Industry Association, represented here today by Mr. Vogel, represents a successful private purchasing cooperative. Of course, while each of these models can be called an exchange, they are in fact quite different. Indeed, the models represented by the House and Senate bills are different in very significant ways. The focus of my paper and of my brief presentation this morning is on how the House and Senate bills differ and on which model is most likely to result in the exchange that serves best the goals that an exchange is intended to fulfill. First, quickly, let me ask you the question, why do we need an exchange? What do we expect an exchange to accomplish for us? The exchange is intended to play a number of roles in healthcare reform. And Sarah sort of briefly went over this, but let me go over it again. First, it is expected to be the locus of managed competition among health insurance plans. It is hoped that the exchange will focus competition on price and quality rather than on risk avoidance, and will thus make health insurance more affordable and thus more accessible. Second, the exchange is expected to create a sizable risk pool that will, together with the insurance reforms found elsewhere in the bill, allow insurance risk to be more efficiently managed, reducing the incidence of adverse selection by insureds and the practice of risk selection by insurers. Third, it is hoped that the exchange will reduce administrative costs by simplifying marketing and premium collecting and by eliminating risk-based underwriting and simplifying the packages that insurance companies put together for insurance as well. Fourth, the exchange offers the possibility of making health insurance markets more transparent and facilitating consumer choice among health insurance plans by standardizing plan offerings and providing more and better information about health insurance options. Fifth, the exchange may play a regulatory role, helping to make insurers more accountable. In particular, it could serve as a forum for reallocating risk among insurers and for guaranteeing that those who sell comprehensive health insurance coverage, that those insurers sell comprehensive health insurance coverage with manageable cost sharing, and that they market their plans fairly, that they respond properly to consumer claims and complaints as well. Sixth, The exchange will likely play a role in facilitating other key features of the health care reform legislation, such as the payment of premium credits or even perhaps the imposition of the individual or employer mandates. In many respects, the House and Senate bills, provisions governing exchanges, are quite similar. Both the House and Senate bills, for example, permit individuals in the non-group market and employees of small employers to purchase health insurance through the exchange. Both require that health plans offered through the exchange offer standardized essential benefit packages that are arranged by tiers, basically based on cost sharing or actuarial value, to facilitate consumer choice. Both bills contain an extensive range of transparency and disclosure requirements to facilitate choice and improve insurer accountability. Both provide premium subsidies, which will cover over half of uninsured individuals in the non-group market and that are only available through the exchange. Both give the exchange some discretion over whether or not to offer health plans and thus some bargaining power with insurers. Both bills generally outlaw risk underwriting by insurers and pre-existing conditions exclusions, and both bills contain a program for reallocating risk among insurers, although the programs in the two different plans for risk allocation are very different. Both finally allow grandfathered plans to exist outside the exchange, which will undermine its ability to pool risk. The bills, however, differ in key respects. Which approach is in the end taken will have a profound influence on implementation and effectiveness. First, the House bills put responsibility for creating exchanges on the national government. The House bill creates a national exchange, but allows states that can create effective alternative exchanges, like presumably Massachusetts, to opt out. The Senate bill, on the other hand, places the responsibility for forming exchanges on the states. It depends on each of the states to first enact legislation that will mirror the federal legislation in terms of the insurance reforms and in terms of creating exchanges, and then to proceed to create each state its own exchange or sub-state exchanges. If a state declines the invitation to do so, or if the Department of Health and Human Services determines that a state has failed to do so, HHS can set up an exchange in the state or contract with a nonprofit organization to do so. But this will depend on the federal government effectively determining that a state has failed to comply with the law and stepping in after the fact. The state exchanges are also, it should be noted, an unfunded mandate. There's no federal money in the legislation for the states to implement these exchanges. They're going to have to pay for them themselves, presumably by taxes that will be imposed on insurers. The bill provides only startup funds for the exchanges and expects them to be self-supporting once they are underway. State-based changes have, in fact, certain advantages, including perhaps a better knowledge of local insurance markets and regulatory environments. But national markets offer larger risk pools and greater efficiency. You don't have to set up 50 exchanges, each with its own programs, each with its own capacity to do all the functions exchange will do. You could have one program. The federal government already has extensive experience with running exchange-like programs like the FEHBP, the Medicare Advantage program, the Medicare Part D prescription drug program. The latter two programs include, in fact, risk adjustment programs, which will probably be part of the exchange, or at least part of the insurance regulation system. Most importantly, a national program promises uniform implementation of the exchange. If some states want to go beyond the federal program, the House bill allows them to do that. But it does not mean, but it does mean that no state will be allowed to lag behind, that no state will be allowed to simply refuse to set up an exchange and then have the federal government step in belatedly and try to clean up the mess. The second biggest difference between the House and Senate bill is the exclusivity of the exchange. The House bill requires all non-group health insurance coverage, other than grandfathered coverage, to be sold through the exchange. The Senate bill allows a non-group market to exist outside the exchange and does not require policies sold outside the exchange to meet all of the requirements that must be met by qualified plans that are sold through the exchange. This leaves the door, I believe, wide open to adverse selection by enrollees and risk selection by insurers against the exchange. Both bills also allow a small group market to exist outside the exchange, which I think to some extent threatens the same difficulty. The Senate bill partially compensates for its open market by requiring insurers to include all insureds in and out of the exchange in the same risk pool, and requires issuers of qualified health plans to charge the same premiums in and out of the exchange for the same plan, by requiring insurers outside the exchange to cover the same essential benefits in the same tiers of actuarial value. And finally, the Senate bill operates its risk reallocation program both inside and outside the exchange. But the Senate bill, I believe, leaves the door open for insurers who decide to stay completely out of the exchange to set up plans that are configured to attract the best risks away from the exchange and leave the exchange with more expensive high-risk groups. Thus, the Senate bill will also require a greater amount of regulatory oversight because it will require the states, not the exchange, but the states, to collect enough data on plans inside and outside the exchange so that it can risk adjust between plans in and out. It seems to me that it's far easier simply to require all insurance in the non-group market to be sold through the exchange. A third difference involves the authority of the exchange with respect to health plans. In particular, does the exchange merely offer whatever plans insurers make available, or does it have regulatory authority as well? Both the House and Senate bills contemplate an exchange with some regulatory authority, making insurers disclose certain information or participate in the risk adjustment program, for example. The House bill goes further, however, and explicitly contemplates the exchange receiving bids from the insurers and negotiating the terms of the insurance plans with the insurers. While the terms of these negotiations are not specified, the legislative language leaves room open, for example, for the exchange to negotiate with respect to issues like premiums, medical loss ratios, administrative costs, etc. The manager's amendment to the Senate bill, on the other hand, also allows the exchange to take excessive premium increases into account in certifying plans, and in fact requires generally that the exchange certify plans as in some general language like being in the best interest of the insured. So I believe that the Senate bill as well leaves some discretion for the exchange, particularly after the manager's amendment, to negotiate with plans with respect to issues like premiums. There are other differences between the bills that we can address in questions. The House bill still includes a public plan, maybe for another few hours, to be offered through the exchange. The Senate bill, of course, includes these multi-state plans that are offered through OPM, and so the Senate bill actually layers one exchange on top of another exchange, which can lead to some interesting dynamics. The Senate bill bars undocumented workers from purchasing insurance through the exchange. The House bill only bars them from receiving premium subsidies. The Senate bill has stronger transparency and disclosure requirements. I believe that the transparency and disclosure requirements in the Senate bill are exceptionally good, and requires the exchange to rate health plans, which is not in the House bill. The Senate bill requires qualified health plans to provide quality assurance programs, which the House bill does not. Neither bill, and I don't know how much opportunity there is to slip in anything at the last minute, but neither bill really addresses the question of privacy of health data in the hands of the exchange. And under current HIPAA statute and regulations, I don't see that the exchanges are automatically covered. So it seems to me that that's a simple fix that perhaps could require some attention. A key point, however, is that although the exchange holds great promise as a health policy tool, we also have a history of some pretty disappointing experience with exchanges. We're going to hear today about some good experiences with exchanges, but a number of states have tried exchanges that have failed. We have a chance to get it right with this legislation, to come up with a powerful tool for improving access, controlling costs, perhaps even improving the quality of health insurance and health care. It is very important that Congress gets it right, and I thank the Commonwealth Fund and the Alliance for sponsoring this this meeting today to allow us to talk about that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Tim. And by the way, in Tim's paper, there is an executive summary up front, the text in the back, and wedged between them is one of the neatest charts you're ever going to see that summarize the differences and similarities in the two bills, and I commend that to you. Next, we turn to John Kingsdale. We have the clicker to pass over there. Thank you. John's the executive director of the biggest real-world pilot of a real-world insurance exchange this side of the federal employee plan. That would be the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority set up by the Massachusetts Landmark Reform Law from 2006. John's worked for more than 20 years in the private insurance world. He's taught at the Harvard School of Public Health, at BU and Tufts, even did a stint at reporting for Forbes magazine. And many of you have called him, I know, for answers during the debate as you try to shape this language, not just on the exchange but on related topics. John, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Thank you, Ed. And that was a very helpful introduction from Sarah and Tim on the basics. And I don't know how much further I'm going to go, so in case I lose you, and it's easy to do in insurance, and I've been in it since almost the Civil War now, you usually lose myself. The takeaway here is humility. There's more that we don't know than that we do know about how the House and Senate versions, visions, would actually play out. I'm so pleased that Phil Vogel is here. Phil runs an exchange next door in Connecticut, which both of ours are state exchanges, and we couldn't be more different. His is basically for small employers, ours is basically for individuals, just to give you one example. So when you've seen a House version or a Senate version, you've seen one out of 1,000 permutations that may play out. That said, let me try to shed a little light. I start from the premise that this is perhaps the most challenging domestic implementation of a domestic policy initiative, at least in this century. That's easy. That's only 10 years, but I would go back maybe another century. It's personal. It's complicated. It's partisan, to say the least. Then, of course, cost control, which is far more ambitious than we were in Massachusetts. We just did access expansion. We're now actually phase two working on cost control, because that means taking money away, always a popular activity. That's even harder, and so the House and the Senate and the administration will be congratulated for taking on the two toughest issues in American politics, I think, at once. And as has been noted, most exchanges have failed. So I feel a little like the 14th century or 15th century European map makers describing trying to chart terra incognita. And then I have a personal bias, frankly, that implementation is 90% of the game. I know there are a lot of folks here who probably are focused on the act, but I actually believe that it lives or dies based on implementation. So a lot of humility. I would start with saying that the way to improve the odds that an exchange of any sort will work is to define very realistically a very limited set of objectives. And I won't go into the details, but when I hear some of the objectives set forth in policy papers that run to the half dozen or dozen objectives for exchanges, I shudder. Acknowledge, secondly, and compensate for the weaknesses in each bill. They each have some weaknesses. I'll get into that. And then try to resource them for whatever exchange we come up with adequately for implementation. Most of what an exchange operator will have to encounter has not even been thought of. It will depend on the circumstances as they evolve under a whole new set of realities. So realistic objectives. I think there are maybe three that are partly doable. One is to reduce administrative costs of buying insurance. There is tremendous waste, if you will, or cost in the distribution of insurance, particularly in the non-group and small group end of insurance. And that's clearly a target that we ought to be able to improve. Secondly, to improve consumers' shopping buying experience, and particularly, again, in the non-group and small group end of the market. Just by way of illustrating this, I actually, to this day, 4 years after we got started to get up and running, get stopped and thanked on the street by people who use the Health Connector in Massachusetts to buy insurance themselves or for their 22-year-old kid, because instead of spending half the morning trying on the telephone to compare four sets of insurance policies from four different carriers and then coming away with a bunch of scribbled notes, they can go on our website and in typically 20 to 30 minutes compare fairly reasonably comparable products, push a button, and get enrolled. And I wouldn't underestimate the importance for success and implementation of a massive health reform just being able to serve your customers well. And then finally, adding some price resistance to the premium setters, and I used to be one, on the health plan side. You know, most of the costs they're trying to price for, they don't control. They're generated by doctors, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera. And through bid negotiation and managed competition choice, we may be able to add a little price resistance and a little more fortitude on the part of the negotiators and take down, as I say, through administrative efficiencies, some of their what they retain of premiums as well. So those are three fairly modest goals. Now to how to improve or work with what we have on the table in front of us. I'd say there's some weaknesses in both bills. First of all, industry resistance. To get very basic, an exchange is an automated store for insurance. Well, you don't run a store if you don't have any products. And there's typically no way to compel a producer to sell through you. Even if you require it, unless you close off all other stores, they're pretty good about finding the store they want to sell through. So one thing would be their resistance to an exchange. And this will, you can deal with it through making an exclusive channel. That's one way. Certainly that's practical for non-group. I think that's completely impractical in this country for group insurance, small or large. Make additional segments evolutionary, see if the exchange is working, can build on its track record, can in fact invite participation, both customers and producers, and then provide for some flexibility, particularly when you get beyond the non-group market. Small group is a local market. It's different in Connecticut than it is in Massachusetts, not to speak of Mississippi or Alaska. And there are actually provisions in the House bill that I'm pretty convinced will end up having absolutely zero small employers use the national exchange they're in envision. We can talk about that if you want. Secondly, adverse selection is a major issue. This is a whole complexity, options, new rules. All these encourage adverse selection. It's the easiest way to make your bottom line as a carrier be positive. One way to counter that would be, again, exclusive channel for non-group and risk adjusting within that. A second way is certainly claims-based risk adjustment, but it has to be across the entire market segment. So if you're risk adjusting for small group, you can't just do it in the exchange. You have to do it across the entire market. And then finally, coming back to a point about options, frankly, foregoing the large group market, if it's an option for large groups and they can do choice themselves, the only large employers you're likely to get into the exchange are the ones that somebody else wants to dump there. And then thirdly, cost control tools. Bid for plan selection, that's absolutely critical. The House is very clear on that. The Senate's a little muddier, but I think they're pretty much there. Standardizing benefits over time, and this comes back to the fact that we're stores for health insurance. So in Massachusetts, for example, over 3 years, the connector has come to standardize benefits. But in 2007, when we started, we didn't know which benefits would sell, which designs were preferred. So we had to evolve over time to standardizing benefits. And then automate, automate, automate. There is a tremendous amount of administrative efficiencies to be gained. Now, turning to the House legislation for a minute, I think one of the problems, and Tim referred to it, is what I call market insensitivity. And as I said, I think that's only one of several reasons why there's likely to be zero, and I say zero, small group participation in the national exchanges currently envisioned. Another reason is that all the premiums are supposed to flow directly from employers to carriers, and so having a model where Joe's gas station with five employees has to get billed and pay to five different carriers in order to offer choice to his five employees is pretty much a non-starter. So I'd suggest maybe focusing where the strengths of that exchange are, which is in the non-group market. It's far less complex, it's less nuanced, and geographic portability is critical. Most small businesses don't change states. Delegate and decentralize where possible. It's clearly hampered by the focus on a Washington-based or national management structure. And then finally, emphasize the customer experience. Again, this is where policy hits reality. This is where the backlash will be very real and very tangible for that god-awful big monster created in Washington, and it doesn't actually get me insurance when I go online. Secondly, there's a whole issue about regulation versus retailing. Clearly, the House vision is one for an exchange to be more of a regulator than I think the Senate suggests. Maybe that can be done, but there's got to be a limited set of goals, a considerable amount of independence for the agency that administers this, the Health Choices Administration, to figure out what works, to try different things, not to be micromanaged by a board of directors made up of 435 representatives and senators. I'd suggest minimizing the policing role. If you want to actually sell insurance, which is basically the mission of an exchange, nobody buys it, you haven't done anything, you're going to have to be somewhat less of a policeman, and maybe that means regulating carriers more through state divisions of insurance than through some national exchange, which is trying to regulate the producer of the product while it sells the product. And then finally, I think customer experience, as I've alluded to before, is potentially a weakness in the House version, and their flexibility, phasing in, not prescribing every element of transparency, encouraging pilots would be very helpful. Turning to the Senate, I think there are a number of problems, and I'm going to add a fourth one. Scale economies is clearly one. There'll be much more scale, and as a web-based electronic store, the fixed costs are pretty substantial, and scale is critical to administrative efficiency, and national is by definition bigger than state by state. But you can make that the exclusive channel for non-group, and I think that's worth about, in Massachusetts that would be 100, subsidized and unsubsidized would be 300,000 people. And at that point, even a modest-sized state exchange has gotten 90% of the scale economies it can get out of volume. So, 300,000 is a pretty good, at that point you're not getting much incremental savings from growth. Developing national utility functions, a national web-based tool that the state exchanges could use. Secondly, geographic portability. Particularly in the non-group market, people move, they split their time between states, et cetera. But the key here is to have national plans, not a national store. As long as you can buy national plans, that's the key. And that could be supplemented by reciprocal arrangements among regional plans and by federal standards of interoperability among state-based exchanges. Consistent performance, clearly inconsistency of performance is a problem, and there's some sort of conventional wisdom things noted on the PowerPoint. But finally, I would add dependence on state interest, energy, support, and resources is somewhat of an Achilles heel here. There is a provision for the feds to step in, but given the controversiality that has come to characterize this entire reform effort, there is a realistic prospect some states will do everything they can to actually make this fail, to be perfectly blunt, and depending on them to run the exchange could be problematic. And then finally, I would turn to the last point about resourcing and evolving exchanges. We are entering into a period, if the Act passes, of maybe at least a decade of re-legislating, of trying, of figuring this out. So some degree of independence for exchanges to figure out what works, focusing their funding. I like the Senate version much better, which has funding tied to sales a surcharge on the premiums you actually, the transactions actually happening with the exchange. I think that focuses the exchange properly on its most core mission, to get a whole bunch of people insured. Secondly, clear objectives but flexible means. We just don't know. There's so much more that we don't know than what we do know about how these things are going to work. Drive, as I said, to electronic transactions and to audit trails. There is a huge wash of billions of dollars annually envisioned in these exchanges and a very, very murky set of auditing instructions. And then finally, rigorous evaluation over time. So I hope that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our final speaker is Phil Vogel. He's the Senior Vice President at CBIA Service Corporation, a division of the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, CBIA. Phil's in his third decade at CBIA, and the Services Corporation offers health insurance, among other things, to the thousands of members of CBIA. He's also spent a dozen years in the private insurance business directly. He's been a certified life underwriter for more than 30 years. And his division has really led the way in setting up a statewide health insurance purchasing alliance that allows workers and the small business members of CBIA to choose among several different companies and policies. So we're really anxious to hear the kind of experience that that you've had and the success that you've had. Phil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. And I think you've heard a lot of good ideas from the panelists, and I'm probably going to repeat some of it, but I'm also going to try and take you into the private sector a little bit. As we've operated, at one point it was called a HIPIC, because we really designed CBI Health Connections during the Clinton era under the managed competition model, thinking that you could set out an exchange and people would make decisions based on price, network, satisfaction, and quality data. And that's what we were trying to do when we introduced our program. I'm going to repeat some of the things that were set up here, because I think there's a lot of very good things said. But what I'm going to try to do is give you a view into the private sector and into an exchange that's been running for over 15 years. As I said, CBI is a not-for-profit. We run the program out of a for-profit subsidiary, CBI Service Corps, a la we pay our taxes for any of the services that we provide. And basically, coming from a state that is very high in insured, we only have an uninsured rate of around 10% or so, we have very high mandates. We have a lot of other practices in place, yet we're able to compete in the private sector. Nobody has to come and buy through us. This is totally voluntary if a small business were to come to our exchange and buy through us. So we look at a very, very competitive marketplace and how we work. So what I'd like to do is try and take you through that, a little bit of what we are, why we're successful. I need to give you some background in Connecticut of the rating rules that we operate under, because those are a lot of the rules that we're talking about federally in both the House and the Senate bills. What we do, and maybe some of the lessons that we've learned over time, and then some of the opportunities. We introduced our program January 1, 1995. It is an employee choice model. What does the employee choice model mean? It means we have four health plans that we contract with. Each employee can choose from that one of those four health plans and a whole wide range of benefits from benefit levels from those companies. We have over 5,000 companies and over 75,000 members in Connecticut that participate. One of the things that we've talked about so far, and one of the things John really emphasized and Tim, is really looking at the adverse selection. One of the hallmarks of our program when we first started was we sat back and we tried to standardize the benefits between the four health plans so we could avoid adverse selection. So we have come very close to having standardized benefits between the four health plans starting on day one in 1995. As I said, we tried to determine and set this program out under managed competition. The choice was based on price, network. As things have evolved, people make now decisions based on the formularies that different networks have and the satisfaction rates. Unfortunately, over time, we had an objective when we first started of having quality data that patients and individuals and employees could make decisions on, and that data still is not available at this point in time. So why do we think we've been successful? First, we think we brought employee choice to the marketplace for employees and their and to employers. But what we one of the things that we know is that the employees trust their employers, and they want to buy their insurance through their employee and they trust them. But we have to make sure that we add value to the entire marketplace, to each individual, to each company, to each of the insurers, so that the entire market is getting a win-win-win, and that's how we've tried to manage our program throughout. There's been an evolution as we've looked through our program of where we started it. We tried to set out specific rules, but we've had to change dramatically over the last 15-plus years that we've been doing this. As John mentioned, health insurance is very, very personal. It touches each individual. It touches their families. And each situation is different, and you need to try and figure out how you can attract and make sure that you're marketing to each of those individuals and satisfy their specific needs. We have stayed true to our mission the entire time and only focused on small business. We didn't get distracted and go into the large business, into the non-group business. We've stayed true to keeping our objectives, as John was saying, keep your objectives straightforward and make sure that you concentrate on those objectives and not get distracted. Now, from the private sector, and of course I'm going to be biased because I'm coming in from the private sector side, that from our standpoint, innovation is absolutely the key. You have to be able to set out to be able to change and adapt. When we started this, we hired employees so that we could administer our program. And I said two things to those employees when we hired them. Number one, I guarantee you two things. I guarantee you change, and I guarantee you we forgot something. That was the only two things that they were told when we first started with them. And that has come true because we have changed dramatically over the times, and they have to have the ability, we have to have the ability to change as you go forward. The selection issues, as I said, adverse selection is ripe in this. In the when you're competing in the outside market, it is absolutely critical that adverse selection is avoided. And I'm going to talk about a little about the background of that in two slides as we go forward. What we do from CBI's standpoint is we look like one large employer to the health plan, but we do everything. And I have to say one of the differences from our exchange is that we are the exchange in the sense that we have designed the program and we've negotiated all the contracts with health plans, et cetera, but we're also the administrator. So we are actually doing the day-to-day operations in the sense that we will do all of the proposing of what the rates would be and the benefits if a company's looking for a quote. We'll actually sell it, enroll it, hold enrollment meetings if need to be, handle any of the billing problems. We send eligibility to the health plans on a daily basis, collect premium, remit premium. There's one simple bill that goes out to the employer. So we are trying to provide everything that needs to be taken place through all the communications to all the different segments that we're serving. So it's we do differ in the from that standpoint. So what have we learned? Well, we've learned, number one, that actually I think I skipped one slide, which was critical. Let me come back to this slide for one second, and that's the rate basis. The basis for Connecticut is we passed small case reform laws in Connecticut in the early 90s, and what that did is it gave us adjusted community rating, so there was no decisions that could be made based on claims. There are no rate bans, no nothing, so that we have adjusted community rating. We have guarantee issue, guaranteed renewability. We do have some rating factors being the age, the area, dependent status, et cetera, that can change some of the rates. And we do have a reinsurance pool behind the scenes. But this piece has been very important for us. It also helps with the adverse selection so that the marketplace is not trying to make decisions based on risk, and that's what John and Tim have talked about, has been very, very important. So that, as a backdrop, that has been very important for us, and it's a lot of things that are included in both the state, both in the federal bills, the House, and the Senate. So some of the lessons as we move forward. I talked about a little about the adverse selection. We have tried to avoid adverse selection from day one. One of the problems is if you're simply looking for administrative expenses and just to save the administrative expenses, we have a real problem. Because even in the bills that they talk about in group marketplace, they're looking for an 85% loss ratio, non-group 80% loss ratio. Even if you save a little bit there, you're not hitting the 80 or 85%, which is a claims dollar. And that's what you have to look at. You've got to also try and figure out how can we change the risk profile underneath to help look at the claim side. I have a real problem with putting the loss ratios in there only because it stifles innovation. It stifles the ability of companies to invest in what they would do to help manage the care, help consult on the care, or help drive down some of the claim costs that we're talking about. I can comment later on some of the broker compensation variances, but we have not allowed any in our program whatsoever, and we also look to make sure that we're consistent with what the market does outside of the exchange. Some of the things to think about, well, there's some unintended consequences, and we use the unintended consequences all the time for what may take place if we make certain decisions. I really think some of the age pieces, the House has a 2-to-1 rate bands on pricing. The Senate's really talking about 3-to-1. That can be a real problem unless there are very, very strong individual mandates, because if individuals or small businesses start to drop out of the marketplace, the ones that will drop out if there's not a strong individual mandate are the healthier risks, and we will end up with a higher risk pool, higher rates, higher health situations, and that will leave us in a major problem. There are going to be problems in trying to figure out the subsidies and just when you take a look at multiple funding sources and where those dollars are coming in from and how to handle part-time employees, et cetera, those will be situations. The whole risk adjustment, premium redistribution becomes an issue because you now, if you're redistributing premiums, it becomes very tricky because you may be redistributing premiums to a carrier that is not as efficient or working on the risks and reducing the risks like they should be, and you're reducing the pricing. They're helping them reduce their price. And I just find there's minimal focus on wellness and behavior change. And that's a big piece that John and I were talking about prior to us coming up here. But I think the culture of moving as we move forward, we have to look at this. How do we bring something to the small business and non-group market that large companies are doing today? They are trying to figure out how to make a healthier population, how to invest and reduce risks within their population. It's very, very difficult. We have companies in Connecticut that we talk to all the time that are doing this. The large companies' trend lines have flattened. If we don't bring that into the small business marketplace and the non-group, we will just exacerbate and continue the problem. I've got a couple questions for you, and I guess I won't show of hands, but they're touchy questions. I would expect everybody in here pretty much knows, if I said, how many of you know how much you weigh? Well, probably most of you would say, okay, I know that. The question is, how many of you know your numbers? And the numbers being, how many of you would know your blood pressure? How many would know your cholesterol, your HDL and LDL? How much would know your glucose? How many would know your BMI? So, and the body weight index. So the question is, as we go forward, we can't just look at administrative expenses and just say the exchange will only reduce expenses. It needs to do more than that. It needs to move forward into how do we actually change the underlying population, the health of that population. If people have multiple risk factors, how do we get that to reduce to they only have one risk factor? And I think we have to look at that as we move forward, and it's something that I'm not hearing much about, and I think it's very important as we go forward.
Okay. Thank you very much, Phil. Now you get a chance to join the conversation. As I said, you can repair to one of the microphones. You can fill out a green card. And let me take the occasion while we're waiting for our audience to do either or both of those things to invite any of the panelists who would like to make some additional comments or responses to do that now. And we have Tim Jost.
Okay. Just three quick comments. One is I agree with John that the small business part of the exchange in both the House and Senate bill is very problematic as to how that's going to work. And other than the very obvious things like the size of the groups that participate, when you start getting into the details of how is this going to work, it gets very complicated. And in particular, the Senate bill seems to me to be rather poorly fleshed out. The problem that John specifically identified of the premiums being paid to the company rather than through the exchange is an artifact of the budget process. The CBO put out a memorandum in spring as to how it was going to score health care reforms, and one of the things it said is that if premiums are paid through the exchanges, that becomes revenues and expenditures of the federal government, which means that any money then that gets sent, you know, all of a sudden the cost of health care reform has gone up dramatically. I'm sure that Congress just didn't want to go there. But it is going to be very problematic, particularly because every individual, as I understand it, in both the House and Senate bill, is going to be individually underwritten with respect to the rating factors that remain, which means that a small business is going to be paying a different premium for every one of its employees if they vary based on age or the other tobacco use, the other factors that are included. So just to respond to that, I agree that that's a real problem, but I think that's why the problem is there. Secondly, with respect to the medical loss ratios, under the House bill, and I believe it's true under the Senate bill as well, medical loss ratios are defined to exclude the costs of improving quality of care. So I think things like disease management programs and chronic care programs, insofar as insurers invest in those, will not be considered to be part of their administrative costs. So I think there is some room there for flexibility and innovation. And then thirdly, with respect to wellness incentives, the Senate bill, in fact, includes a number of provisions to encourage plans participating through the exchange to provide various kinds of quality incentives, including wellness and prevention programs. And also one of the things that was added by, I think it was added by the manager's amendment to the Senate bill, was provision for funding of small businesses to provide wellness programs like larger businesses increasingly have. So one of the problems that I have, and I think that a lot of us have, is focusing excessively on Title I of the bill and forgetting the other eight titles to the bill. But there is a lot on prevention and wellness in the back of the bill, some of which is going to help out small businesses. So I just wanted to point out those things, and also just to thank the other participants, because I learned so much when you talk to people who are actually doing this.
And one of those participants has a comment. John?
Just picking up on the first point, Tim, about the CBO ruling on the impact of running premiums to the exchange on the federal budget. I actually happen to have been reading the
seven-pager on
my way down this morning, because it is a critical piece of technicality that I'm in no position to dispute it. My point only is, if that's the controlling consideration, I do not believe there will be any small group enrollment through exchanges, and there are a whole lot of senators and congressmen who kind of look to the exchange to be, frankly, a bit of a panacea for small group for small employers who are suffering horribly with rate increases. So that's a problem. I actually would read this, by the way, as suggesting, as clearly indicating that under the Senate version, where states are given the option to run premiums through their exchange or not, and where there's a broad range of benefits that are qualified health plans down to 60% actuarial value, that under that construction, the premiums, the private sector premiums, would not be on budget. They would be, the revenues would be offset by the expenses, and only the net would be on budget. My larger point, of course, is that however the CBO technical reading is resolved, one cannot look to an exchange, which is an automated yellow pages, to be a vehicle of managed competition and choice for small employers.
And just to say quickly, too, there's language in there that says that even though expenditures are run through the states, if they are administering the program under federal direction, that the states may be considered as agents of the federal government for budget purposes. So I'm not sure the Senate can completely avoid this, but I think you're right that they probably are going to have an easier time avoiding it running it through the states. I would hate to see the whole program driven by that. But
CBO runs a lot of things.
I picked that up this year.
Yes, we have folks at the microphones. Let me just ask you to identify yourself and ask anyone who stands up and asks a question to be as brief as you can so that we can get to as many questions as we possibly can. Yes?
Al Milliken, AM Media. How do the exchanges affect the public and private funding for abortion coverage?
Under the Senate bill, exchanges have to, I believe, provide at least one plan that does not cover abortion. Beyond that, and under the House bill, there was provision that they had to cover at least one that did and one that didn't. But I think that came out in the STUPAC amendment. Beyond that, I think the rules for abortion are the rules for abortion, and the exchanges aren't very much involved in them.
The only comment I'd add on that is, and again, this is a perspective of a retailer, if you will, the requirement to resolve this fundamental moral issue that the store pack two products for every one real product.
Yeah.
And put twice, go into a supermarket. The most critical resource is shelf space. And so when the issue is, okay, take two products, one with and without abortion, and put them next to each other for every one of your 100 different plans, you've just made it twice as hard to shop. Probably not a major consideration for people who care, to their core about abortion, but if you're thinking about exchanges, which is the topic of our session today, it's actually a real problem.
Okay, we have tons of questions on cards, which leads me to tell you that if you have an urgency about getting your question asked, we may have done a bait and switch here because you might not get your question asked off from the green card. You may have to stand up and be heard. Let's start with a very straightforward question. Can you compare the administrative costs to states in the Senate and House bills?
The administrative costs to states in the House bill are minimal because if a state wants to run an exchange, it can. It will have to pay matching funds for doing that. But if the state chooses not to run an exchange, it has no administrative costs involved. And the Senate bill, the states are responsible both for enforcing the law and for running the exchanges. The cost of running the exchanges, the presumption is, will be borne by the insurers who will pay some kind of a surcharge, as they do in Massachusetts, I believe, don't they? But the costs of enforcement will be borne by the state. It's an unfunded mandate. The administrative costs to the states under the Senate bill, I think, are going to be considerable.
I guess I would take issue with the term unfunded mandate. Clearly, in the House version, if a state doesn't offer the service, it doesn't have to pay anything. On the other hand, it's perfectly unclear what level of federal subsidies, if any, really will be available to states from the federal treasury, from the federal budget, to pay for a state exchange. On the other hand, I actually think having the states that run exchanges surcharge the transaction, which is why they're in business, and actually have to manage the costs of their services in a competitive market is a perfectly reasonable way and focuses the objectives of the local or regional or state exchange on its fundamental objective, which is to get people insured in the most affordable way. So I actually would take some issue with you at describing it as an unfunded mandate.
Well, I was talking about the enforcement cost, not the cost of running the exchange. But, yes.
Let me just follow up. There's a related question here that notes health insurance is regulated at the state level today. If the exchange is created at the federal level, who would staff the federal exchange, and how much would creating that new structure and running it cost? Does anybody have any notion about that? I don't remember seeing anything in the cost estimates.
The federal exchange would be run by the Commissioner of Health Choices, which is a new administration that's going to be created under the House bill. The costs of running the exchanges is to be appropriated by the federal government based on funds collected from the penalty for the employer and the individual mandate. And I don't know what the cost is that CBO has put on that. In fact, I'm not sure that there is a cost that's been put on that by CBO.
Okay. Sarah, you have some cards that are...
Here's a question. How will the Senate approach with 50-state exchanges work in the 10 smallest states with under a million population?
If I can magnify that, there's a new paper that I don't think we had in time to put into your packets from the Committee for Economic Development, Joe Minerick and his colleagues, which asserts that you need at least 100,000 lives in an exchange to make it viable.
I think a further problem is that since under the Senate bill, the exchange is not exclusive in the non-group market. And since the presumption of the Senate is that a considerable number of people will stay outside of the exchange in the non-group market, I think that you're going to be dealing with some very small exchanges that I think are going to have a problem with providing insurers with viable risk pools and also attracting enough insurers that they can be viable in small states. Now, the Senate bill contemplates the possibility of regional exchanges. Of course, the state could always forego the exchange and let the federal government run it or contract to run it. But I think that, again, that's, I think, part of the problem that I was pointing to with respect to the size of viable risk pools.
So if you take a business approach, a business analysis to this, you've got basically three sets of costs. You've got the business functions that are variable in selling insurance. You've got the fixed costs, and you've got the what Tim was referring to as some of the mandated functions, the unfunded mandate, which I think he makes a good point about, which is the regulatory functions, the policing functions, and the subsidy distribution functions. I would draw your attention to the fact that it's really the fixed overhead costs of the business functions that are largely where the economies of scale can be from having size. So, you know, when Phil's folks are on the phone with employer XYZ explaining to Joe's gas station why they have to file this new form and why they can't pay somebody more for his health benefits than somebody else under federal regulation, or what the difference is between a PPO and an HMO, or any of the other myriad of questions involved in servicing a client and selling, that's largely variable costs. You could have it centralized in somebody in Washington or Baltimore or whatever who would actually not really understand the Connecticut market trying to answer those questions over the phone, or you could have somebody in Hartford and it would cost probably no less or no more in general. What you're going to have the scale economies on are, and some of the regulatory enforcement things are also highly variable. I think where you have the scale economies are in some of the regulatory functions, the website, corporate overhead, you know, sort of overall management of this entity. And there, I think, I don't know about the 100,000 as a reasonable trigger point for adequate risk pooling, but the experience we have in Massachusetts is that somewhere between about 50 and 100,000 is where you get sort of, you start to get diminishing returns on scale for those web-based functions. They could be, if they really turn out to be some super-duper stuff you could do with 10 million people, which is clearly bigger than any state exchange would have, you could have a national utility function run by the feds. They'll need one for their own exchange in whatever 17 or 3 or 27 states don't step up to the line, and they could and could and should make that available to the states that do have their own exchanges.
Yes, go right ahead.
I'm Christine Monahan with the National Partnership for Women and Families, and I was wondering, to go off what you mentioned with the regional exchanges, so if the Senate language prevails and we form, various states form regional exchanges, How do they reconcile the different state laws, like rating rules and other regulations? Will they all have to harmonize, get the same laws if they're under the same exchange?
So that's, I got a very brief answer. That's a really good question, and it's in minor scale compared to the same question for 50 states and one exchange. I mean, it's a very good issue, and to be perfectly frank, I've had a, maybe it's happened, but I have not, in a year of discussions with folks on the Hill, heard an in-depth discussion of harmonizing national or regional exchanges with local, with state insurance regulation. And I know in Massachusetts, we work hand in glove with the State Division of Insurance. So, for example, if we want to take a new, an existing product off the market because we are standardizing our benefits, and Phil and I have both alluded to that, that directly impacts the division, the Massachusetts Division of Insurance regulations on preserving access for the existing members of that product you would like to sunset. And that's something we work out in conjunction with the Massachusetts Division of Insurance. So were the national or the New England exchange to want to do something similar, they've got to deal with 50 or 6 different agencies and sets of rules around just switching out a product within the exchange. So it's a really good question, and it's magnified on the national scale.
And I'll agree with that. I mean, with John's comment, because anytime we're making changes within our exchange, even though we're operating the private sector, we are taking a look at the insurance law. We are talking to the insurance department, and sometimes meeting with the insurance department to determine what we can do going forward. So, and as I said earlier, it touches everybody. It is local, so it really needs. You know, I think as it plays out, it's going to play out more at the state level. It's got to coordinate with the states.
One response to that, though, is that I anticipate considerable standardization of state insurance laws under health care reform, if probably under both bills. But the House bill, basically the way the House bill works as I see it, is that it doesn't nationalize insurance regulation as such. What it does is it says that the national government, we are doing a national health care reform, the national government, specifically the Commissioner for Health Choices, is accountable, is responsible for the enforcement and implementation of this law. And then there's lots of language about coordination, consultation, joint efforts with the states to try to implement the law. But number one, a lot of the issues that are currently addressed by at least state marketing and consumer protection laws are addressed by this law and presumably will become fairly uniform. They do not preempt state law. It's not ERISA. But they do cover a lot of the areas that are covered by state law, and to the extent that a state law would prevent the implementation of the law, that law will be preempted. Secondly, a lot of the difference among the states currently is in terms of mandates. Well, under both the federal and state law, if a state wants to mandate coverage beyond the essential benefit coverage, it is going to have to pay for that coverage for anyone receiving a premium subsidy. And my expectation is that that's going to create a race to the door to get rid of a lot of state mandates that vary from state to state. So I guess my response is that, number one, we're going to see more uniformity between state law and the federal health reform law once this law is adopted. And number two, that in any event, the federal law has, the House bill at least, has this attitude of cooperation and coordination that I think is going to help work through those problems. But that will be an issue. I guess the fear that I have is sort of the reverse of that, that if you go with the Senate approach, a lot of states, frankly, are pretty weak on insurance regulation. And they're going to stay that way, and they're going to be responsible for and a number of states have already indicated that they don't like the law and they don't want to have anything to do with it, but I'm not sure they're all going to opt out. I think some of them may well just sort of sit there and then see if the federal government will call their bluff, and I think that's going to be a real disaster.
And I think, you know, I agree that some of the things are going to come together, you know, the guarantee issue, guaranteed renewability, and some of the rating rules and how you rate are going to come together. But some of the pieces are going to be very far apart. Connecticut is one. You talk mandates. That's something we talk about all the time. Connecticut has a very high list of mandates. And Well, I've been in the business a long time, and I've never seen one mandate reversed.
Are they going to be willing to pay for all of them out of their own pockets?
They're.
I mean, maybe. I don't know.
I can't say. I can. I know it's been.
So let me jump in with a great example. I'm shocked to begin to realize that my 10-member board will seriously begin after enactment to debate whether we should have our own MCC, our own state assessment penalties for violation of MCC, et cetera, on top of and in addition to the federal ones. That's how sacrosanct states think of the way they do things, even if there is a lot of goodwill in a federal piece of federal legislation.
John, what's MCC stand for?
Oh, I'm sorry, minimum credible coverage. So, you know, there would be under these bills, state, Senate, or House, federal IRS enforcement of national standards. We have our own in Massachusetts, and I've just begun to realize how difficult that set of conversations is going to be with our governor, our legislators, and my own board about do we cede that to the federal standards, or do we overlay ours on top of the federal standards? After all, it's a revenue source, and for our state treasury right now.
Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, Matthew Gever, National Conference of State Legislatures. I have two questions. The first, you mentioned that undocumented workers wouldn't be allowed to purchase an exchange under the Senate bill. Could you talk some more about what options might be available to them if they want to go for private insurance, if that was even a possibility? And the second question is, if the tax exemption for health benefits went away, and hence a large group market went away, and that market was forced into the exchange, how do you think their benefits and such might compare? Do you think they'd be better, or consumers would be better or worse off in exchange versus a large group market?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the second question?
Second question is, if the tax benefits for health benefits for employers went away and hypothetically people in large group markets and large employers lost their benefits and went to the national exchange instead of getting through employers, how consumers might fare in the exchange versus getting benefits through employees.
Yeah. I mean, with respect to the first question, under the Senate bill, presumably undocumented, I think the hope is that they'll go home. But if they don't, which I think they're unlikely to, since I live in a town with a great many undocumented workers, if they don't, then under the Senate bill, they can continue to buy health insurance in the non-group market. If that provision were incorporated into the House bill, and the House bill's non-group market is only available through the exchange, I suppose they would not legally be able to buy health insurance. And I think that's a real problem. I might be missing something there. But
Can I
go ahead.
That's the second part of that question is what happens if the large companies, you know, benefits went away and each individual was buying through the exchange their own individual coverage. I think that's what the question was.
Yeah.
If you really take a look at many of the large companies today, their benefits are probably richer than what individuals would purchase for themselves in an exchange. So they probably would definitely be, their benefits would probably be a little less, and I would expect from what takes place in the larger companies, a lot of programs they have in place, that the cost would be probably slightly higher.
I can't imagine that happening, although the Cadillac tax bothers me because, like as it's been said by many people, like the AMT, that is going to grow and grow and grow and grow, and at some point we're going to see a very high percentage of the market subject to that, and that's going to mean a dramatic cut in employee benefits, if not their elimination altogether. So, but I don't – none of the Democrats right now are talking about abolishing the at least that's not going to be in this legislation.
And two-thirds of the population today are buying through their employer side. Yeah. And the slides that Sarah was talking about were showing the employer base staying in place. And I just can't imagine that much dislocation.
Yeah.
In a quick time frame.
Can I just tie those two pieces together? What happens under this legislation, if anything, to undocumented immigrants who are now covered under employer-sponsored plans? Are they legally going to be able to continue?
Well, they're not supposed to be employed. but I don't – the legislation does not otherwise address that.
Fair enough.
Hi, I'm Ann Kemsky with SEIU. I wanted to ask John, I guess in particular, but any of you can answer. My assumption has been that – the small group market would shrink dramatically, that most small employers, I mean, the offer rates of small employers now are very low. Most small employers, if you believe the economists, might give workers a little bit more money and say, go shop in the exchange as individuals, as opposed to trying to preserve the small employer groups. And so, you know, you were really hard on the House bill on the small employer piece. So I just wondered, you're in a state where you've got a lot of experience. I just wonder if you could speak to, would that be so bad to grow the individual market and, you know.
No, actually, Ann, I'm really glad you asked that question because I probably, as usual, miscommunicated. I don't have a problem with the House version focusing on non-group. And that's, I think, when you have a mandate and you're trying to get 30 million people newly insured, many of whom are going to be buying as individuals and need subsidies, that's a huge undertaking and a very appropriate task for a national exchange. I actually think that can work. I just don't think it's going to work for small group. Now, to your real question, which is, so isn't small group kind of going away? I wouldn't bet my firstborn on it. You know, as you know, with a union, there's nothing more meaningful as a maybe the second most important element of compensation after pay is health insurance benefits. And I know Massachusetts is exceptional, but there's still a lot of small businesses around the country. When they're competing for your or my services, whether they offer health benefits as opposed to, well, yeah, but somehow we can prove that we pay you $1,000 more a year for you to go off to this exchange or someplace else or on your own and go buy it. There's really not much of a comparison between those two offers. So I think you've got, you know, 50% or so of the small businesses employing a lot more than 50% of the employees of small businesses across the country offering group insurance. I would not expect that to significantly diminish, particularly because now you have the added incentive as an employer that your employees have to go buy it. Mm-hmm. And they're really looking to you, the employer, not only to help organize the choice, but fundamentally to give them some money with which tax preferred to go buy it. So I don't see small group insurance going away at all.
Plus, both the Senate and the House bills include provisions for tax credits to small businesses to cover their employees. They're short term and they're not that huge, but the CBO does see them as having a significant effect.
Afternoon. Wei Wenung from the National Academy of Social Insurance. Professor Jost, could you go a bit more into how difficult it would be to administer a risk adjustment plan outside the exchange as well as inside it? Also, if the Senate bill were passed as is, would HHS be the best entity to administer that risk allocation system, or would the exchanges be?
Under the Senate bill, there are actually three different risk adjustment mechanisms, two of them short-term, one of them long-term. One of them is a reinsurance program, which is to operate for 3 years. One of them is a risk corridor program, which I can't for the life. I keep thinking this just ended up in the wrong bill because it talks about HHS paying premiums, and HHS isn't paying premiums. So I don't know how that works. I'll be interested to see. I hope. But the third is a risk adjustment program that would take money from insurers with good risks and give it to insurers with bad risks. And that, I believe, is to be operated not through the exchange, but through some other kind of entity that the state is supposed to contract with. I guess the problem that I see with that is, and then what the House bill does is simply risk adjusts the premiums for the premium subsidies to account for risk. And that, it seems to me, is pretty doable. You're going to be dealing within the exchange. You're going to have a lot of data on the plans that are in the exchange and who they're insuring. And it seems to me that that's fairly doable, although it doesn't really address the problem of small group, although maybe John's right and there will be no problem with small group. Because in the House bill, you have small group both in and out of the exchange, and the risk adjustment only takes place within the exchange. with respect to the Senate bill, however, with this risk adjustment program, I mean, it can be done. There are states now, a number of states, that have reinsurance and risk adjustment pools, but I just think it's going to require collecting a lot of information that the states would not otherwise collect.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Lynn Quincy from Consumers Union. First of all, I just want to really thank the Alliance and the Commonwealth and the panelists for a great session. It's been really informative. I have some I'd like additional clarity on how exchanges can help small businesses, which I know is maybe a little odd coming from Consumers Union, but I feel like this is very not clear at all. There are big differences between the bills. In both of them, small businesses can purchase both in and outside the exchange, and I think I heard a panelist say that there's really no other way to do it. In one of the bills, the tax credits are available on both sides. In the other bill, they can only get them in the exchange. In the Senate bill, the exchanges are separate. Should those two exchanges be together? And finally, what can we do to make sure another thing that is very odd is in the House bill, I think, individuals and small groups are pooled together in the exchange, but then there's a separate pooling mechanism that's just small business outside the exchange. And could that possibly create make rates higher for individual non-group participants? I know that's a lot, so in general, I just like to know the panelists' thoughts on what's a good way to help small businesses with respect to exchange design. Thank you.
Let me start with just the exchange itself, and the question I think was, you know, first, why is it good for small business? If you think about it, come back and say, okay, let's say you worked. Typically, when I do this, I do it with a much smaller crowd, and I say we are one little small business, and try and equate it that way. But if you think about it, the exchange brings simplicity and brings the choice for an employee based on their specific needs. We offer four different health plans and a range of benefits, so each employee can choose the specific network that they want. Why is that important? Well, typically, if a company is choosing a benefits, they'll choose from one carrier. That carrier will have one network. They'll have one set of formularies, and the employees, and typically in a small business, that decision is based on where the owner wants to go. Either the owner's decided for the price of the company or based on where their doctors are in which network. So in this situation, typically, the employee now can choose, okay, I don't necessarily have to go to the owner's side, even though the owner's trying to provide a very good benefit. They can now choose based on where the pediatrician is, the OBGYN, based on the formularies, based on anything that they know, even from a satisfaction side, and hopefully at some point we'll have transparency of provider quality and rates, so they can make those decisions as well, and it's going to really, it leads to a high satisfaction rate. I mean, we do a survey of the companies that participate in our program every single year, and we get very, very high satisfaction, and we go into a lot of different questions and what their experience is within the exchange. So that's really an explanation within why a small business gives satisfaction to the business and the employees, because it makes it much simpler. I don't know if we want to add. There was several other questions.
Well, I'd just like to add one thing, and it's a great opportunity to come back to my theme of my talk, humility. Tim explained the theory of choice and managed competition reasonably well, and I would throw in some of those employees will decide to buy up in terms of a more expensive plan. Maybe it's a better brand. Their grandmother had it, whatever. They're willing to pay for it. Others will buy down, and frankly, if they're using their own money as the difference, God bless them. Let them make that decision. And presumably, that's our experience. Most buy down, and it adds price pressure, which hopefully stiffens the spines of the insurers to either take some administrative costs out or go get a better deal from the hospitals they contract with. So that's the theory of managed competition and choice. But you asked a whole lot of other questions, Lindsay, and to be – I want to be humble, and I want to ask other people in this room and in the city to be humble. We don't know the answers to most of those questions, and that's why I think you need to delegate to who's ever doing it some real resources, some real expertise, and some real latitude to learn and adjust and figure it out and make changes as you go along.
Joyce Frieden from Internal Medicine News. I'm interested in what happens to the role of insurance agents and brokers with exchanges, both if there are provisions for that in the House or Senate bills, and what the experience has been in Massachusetts and Connecticut.
So I think we both use brokers. Massachusetts non-group market is not broker-driven. There were no brokers in it, really. So, and that's where we focused in our unsubsidized exchange so far as non-group. So we haven't changed market practice. We don't use brokers there. Now, you contrast this. I'm going to give you an example, coming back to Lindsay's question and my humility. with California, where brokers typically drive the non-group market. There are 3 million non-group insured in California. There were 36,000 in Massachusetts when we started. There are now about 90,000, thanks to reform. And the broker typically gets 10% or more of premium in the first year. So very different broker situations. If Washington were to dictate how to deal with brokers in Massachusetts and California on day one, hard and fast rule, you'd have two very different outcomes, no matter what the rule was, and very possibly chaos in both states. So, you know, hard to know, but where brokers are there, they play an important function. We can argue about how much they're paid, about what their incentives are and so forth, but there's a real function there. Now, one of the reasons, for example, there's no brokers in the non-group market in Massachusetts is we have guaranteed issue, guaranteed renewal, and community rating. In other states, brokers in the non-group market are critical to actually finding a carrier who will take you. So it's very different state to state.
And in the group marketplace, the broker plays, from our standpoint, a very important role. Our average size company that we insure is 7 or 8 employees. They don't have a human resources department. They don't have, some of them don't have access to the internet. Some, you know, they don't necessarily speak English. There's just so many different aspects to it that the broker typically is meeting with those employees and helping them through a very complex, and as we've gone through, I keep saying, their personal decisions. And so they actually played a very important role for us. Now, we paid, well, when we first started in 1995, we kind of changed it, but we pay a market rate that's basically the same as in the exchange as they would get outside the marketplace. Go back to California for something. The California HIPIC was a public sector exchange that came up in 1995 as well. They came up with a program. They said basically the employer could determine if they wanted to use a broker or not, and they would be, here's what the cost would be if they wanted to add on that broker. 75% at the beginning, I believe, used a broker to begin with, and their sales were not as robust as when they said we're going to meet the market, and then their sales were much better, although there's other situations, especially the adverse selection issues that they had to do. The California HIPIC had to do things that the open market didn't, which created a real problem for them. And unfortunately, the California HIPIC is not a viable program anymore.
It was interesting to me to see the evolution of the roles of agents and brokers as the legislation moved through the legislative process, because originally the House bill said nothing about it, and then part of the Blue Dog Amendment said the role of agents and brokers shall not be adversely affected or something like that. And the Finance Committee bill originally said that the Secretary shall come up with rules for setting commissions for brokers, and that disappeared in the Manager's Amendment. So it's obviously that the brokers and agents, and in fact you can see this in the trade press as well, have been following this very closely and are very interested in making sure that they continue to have a role. I think it's absolutely right that with respect to the small group market, agents and brokers will continue to have a role. It's hard for me to see that that agents and brokers, if you fully implement an exchange in the non-group market, it's hard for me to see that an agent and broker is going to add a value added of 10% when you think of all the other things that healthcare costs are supposed to cover. But when I discussed this with somebody earlier in the year, they said, remember, there is an agent and there's an insurance agent or broker in every Kiwanis Club, every Lions Club, every PTO. I mean, when I go to fundraising banquets, some of my best friends are insurance agents and brokers. They're all there. This is, at the grassroots level, one of the most powerful groups in the United States, and it's hard to imagine that they are going to go away. And they do, again, serve a very useful function in the group market. But I would hope that one of the things that the exchanges could do in the non-group market would be to figure out what exactly agents and brokers are contributing in terms of value added, and then make sure that they are compensated commensurately. I don't see any need for 10-20% origination fees. It's like if you could buy through web-based travel platforms and still had to pay a travel agent every time you broke. Anyway, you've heard me.
We have time for the questions from the folks standing at the microphones, first in the back of the room.
Hi, Linda Bennett with AFSCME, and thank you to the panelists and to the Commonwealth Fund and the Alliance for putting this together. My question is about the state exchanges and the history, because in terms of going to scale, this health care reform is proposing to put 30 million people into sort of an exchange, and that's a large scale in terms of having it happen in day one. Wanted to ask you, what have been the obstacles for more states taking on running an exchange that would move us towards that level of scale? And in then looking at what those obstacles are, if you could sort of look through the filter of the Senate bill, which sort of puts it onto states first, and then if they default or refuse or are not so great in doing it, the feds step in. What in the Senate bill helps states to overcome that obstacle so we get on day one, if 20 million, 25 million show up, it's going to work?
That's a great question. And my somewhat informed, I've read all the literature and I've lived one of the exchanges, opinion is that most state or local exchanges have failed because the value proposition in the absence of a mandate, in the absence of subsidies run through the exchange, for the exchange to step in and materially improve the purchase experience and the affordability and value for small employers, which is where they've been focused. And Phil has done a great job, but the value with a modest value proposition. It's, you know, I have a member of my board. He's an actuary. He's an absolute expert in insurance. He runs a little business in Connecticut. He checked out CBAA, loves the concept, very enthusiastic, better deal outside of CBAA. It's hard to believe, I know, but it's not like, I think even Phil would admit, you can get the same product for 20% less through his association. The value proposition has been way overblown. A lot of states jumped in anticipation of the reform under the Clintons, tried this, and found it wasn't really sustainable. What's different about the Senate and the House versions is that subsidies would be in a flow to hundreds to tens of millions of people in connection with purchasing through exchanges. That's a huge difference. That's all the difference in the world. That gives you the scale economies and the heft and the enterprise and the opportunity to develop what's taken Phil 15 years, and I imagine a little bit of cross-subsidy from his parent association, to create the value, which is still probably, you know, if you measured it, a couple of points on the premium. And people move for a couple of points on the premium. I'm not underestimating that. And it's great work. But, and so what's the value for our unsubsidized exchange in Massachusetts? It's literally the difference between spending a half hour on our website and being able to see comparable products and make an intelligent choice and having to spend a day on the telephone and try to read your notes at the end of the day as a decision-making process. But is the price any different? Absolutely not. It's the same price in the exchange as outside the exchange. So we're dealing with fairly marginal differences, except if you have a mandate and subsidies to pay for the insurance.
Two things.
Now the rebuttal.
No. I agree with most of everything. Except that, by the way, there was no cross. Our parent did not help us fund this at all. But in a lot of states looked at trying to bring up exchanges, and again, a lot of it came to what was happening outside the marketplace and how they would have to run an exchange. And the rating rules are different all over the country. And many of the states we talked to were not going to be able to get critical mass. And we keep talking about some of the critical mass. And, you know, I don't know if 100,000 is the right number because we run it at 75,000 now. And we have, you know, we've run it at smaller than that. But they have not been able to really overcome that barrier of some of the market forces outside the exchange need to be similar to what's inside the exchange, or there will be real problems in being able to run that exchange. And that this would take me longer to explain exactly what those pieces were, but that's where the states have had to be very, very careful, and that's why they have not been able to come live.
Yes. Warren Greenberg from George Washington University. I think someone had mentioned that standard benefit packages would be in both the House and the Senate bills. I see them as crucial, but would like to ask you this question. As far as standardized benefit package, do you mean also standardized coinsurance rates and copayment rates as well? Would that be included in a standardized benefit? And two, Who would design these standardized benefit packages? Who would be responsible for leaving in psychiatric care, leaving in mental care, leaving in dental care, so forth?
The answer to that, in both the House and the Senate bill, there is the concept of essential benefits, and it lists the kind of things that need to be covered, like inpatient hospital care, like physician services, like pediatric preventive services, pediatric vision and oral health services. But then it leads to a process which in the which is lined out in great detail, and I don't have it fully committed to memory in both bills, but it's a process that would be an administrative process that would run through HHS, I think, in the Senate bill, and I think run by the Commissioner of Health Choices with an representative's advisory board in the House thing, and then it would be updated through an iterative process. So that's the essential benefits package. With respect to the cost sharing, both bills tier packages in terms of actuarial value, and the Senate has four tiers plus a catastrophic plan that's available to some people, young people and people who are at a I forget what the other category is, can't afford insurance. And the House bill has, I believe, four tiers. And cost sharing then is determined by those tiers. I mean, the tiers basically are defined in terms of actuarial value, and so they basically drive cost sharing. So cost sharing is standardized, and then, of course, there are maximum out-of-pocket limits in both bills, and under the Senate bill there are also, for group health plans, maximum deductibles. But there's a lot of flexibility in both plans. If you want to have a high deductible health plan, you can do it under both bills. Pretty much.
Would that be a way of avoiding high risk individuals?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, one concern I have is that under the Senate bill, every insurer who participates in the exchange has to market both the silver and gold plan, but they don't have to market the bronze plan, which means they can market the bronze plan outside the exchange, or someone can just stay out of the exchange altogether and market the bronze plan. And higher deductible, higher cost-sharing plans tend to attract healthy people. So I do see that as one of the wrinkles in the Senate bill that makes me a little nervous about adverse selection.
One of the things that Tim was saying, but it's worth emphasizing, is that while these actuarial tiers project some overall level of cost sharing, we have used actual tiers, for example, with a $2,000 deductible and a $25 copay, or a zero deductible and a 35% coinsurance. Yeah. So they can be very, very different kinds of cost sharing that have the same sort of overall value from an actuary's perspective. So your point about non-standardization, which is one of the reasons Phil and I, probably Phil originally, but we over time, have moved towards standardized benefits and standardized cost sharing so that you do have some comparability. The range, frankly, of cost sharing in Massachusetts, what we think of as minimum, would be considered middle of the road in Texas. So these tastes, preferences, affordability issues are very different across the country and are going to be a real issue, particularly in the House version, which has a floor at 70%, which is frankly above what most small employers provide in many parts of the country. They provide more cost sharing than 30%.
Standardized benefits is what has been, I feel, one of our keys. If we hadn't had the standardized benefits between the four health plans, you're just opening up problems. And, it's very concerning. And then John's point, across the country, just varies tremendously.
As I turn to Sarah Collins for a final comment, let me just ask you to reiterate my request to you that you fill out those blue evaluation forms so we can continue to improve these programs for you. Sarah?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you so much to the panel. It's just been an excellent conversation, and I do want to just emphasize too how critical this piece of the other reform bills is. We've focused a lot on the public plan over the last year, and some other pieces of the proposals, but I think this really is critical. The individual and small group markets is where people lose their coverage in the United States. They drop through the system at that point. So this is the fix to to those markets if we are going to build on the existing system. And the issues that are raised in Tim's paper and by this panel, I think, are really critically important, both in terms of deciding on the provisions in the bills, federal versus state control, and also implementing the bills over the next the provisions over the next few years. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks to our friends at the Commonwealth Fund for supporting some of the research that was used to such good effect in this conversation, and for supporting and participating in this briefing. Thank you for your fortitude listening to a lot of actuarial terminology over the last hour and a half. And let me ask you to help thank the panelists. I think if the insurance exchanges in whatever form run as well as this exchange has run, the country's going to be well served. So thanks very much to all of you.